Old Testament. All of the books existed. They were records going all the way back to Moses, of course, and through the period of the judges and the kings. There were priests and prophets who wrote these books. But during the Babylonian captivity, they probably almost disappeared, were almost lost. If not but for the work of some scribes to hold on to them and to copy them and to put them together and preserve them, they would have been lost. Now, of course, we know God's hand would have been in that, but God chooses to work through men in this world, and the man he worked through was Ezra. Ezra, I believe, was the guy probably, as I say, more than anybody else who's responsible for the fact that we have the Old Testament in the form that we have it today. And so that means a lot. In terms of his own work in his own lifetime, he was a reformer, a teacher, and a preserver of the practice of the law. And very important in that regard as well, because as one of the returnees, he was perhaps even more than Zerubbabel and Joshua, perhaps even more, and I think more than Nehemiah certainly. Ezra was the guy who held the community together in its devotion to the Lord. And so at a dangerous point where all may have been lost, Ezra was the guy who stepped forward and said, we need to keep this law. And so we should respect and honor the role that he played, and also use his life and his work as an example and a lesson for ourselves as well, because if we don't do our work in our generation, if we don't preserve and protect and uphold and teach, we need to consider what will be lost. And once lost, so difficult to restore. So let's honor Ezra as we study his book starting tonight. Before we go any further, though, let's go ahead and have a word of prayer. And Ryan, would you mind directing us? Amen. Okay, let's go through some introductory material here. That is exactly what Ezra looked like, by the way. I say that facetiously, of course. The Israelites have been carried away into captivity in 586 B.C. And they spent 70 years in captivity. But the 70 years, you know, you calculate two or three different ways, because there's three waves of captivity, and there were two or three waves of returnees. And so, roughly speaking, the period was 70 years. One definite way of calculating the 70 years between the captivity and return is by the destruction of the temple and its final completion. The temple was destroyed in 586. It was finally completed in 516, so there's 70 years. But the first wave of returnees came back in the year 536, 537, and that's represented by this green line. And then there was a second wave that came, some 80 years later, and that was the one that Ezra came on. So the interesting thing about the book of Ezra is it's a little confusing, The first six chapters are about the first returnees who came back in 536 BC. But Ezra doesn't show up until chapter 7 because he was in the second wave that happened some 80 years later. So it gets a little confusing because you're reading the first six chapters and you're thinking, where's Ezra, where's Ezra, where's Ezra? And then he starts talking in the first person in chapter 7, and sometimes people don't snap to the fact that we're talking about two different stories that have a span of at least 58 years between them. Because by the end of chapter 6, they rebuild the temple, but that's 516 B.C. Ezra doesn't come back with a returning group until 458, so there's 58 years between those two events. So you just need to be aware of that. So why does Ezra go back and talk about the first group that returned? Well, because he wants to record that event. He wants to show that there was a return and there was a rebuilding of the temple. And then he comes with a second group of returnees and institutes another wave of reform to try to rededicate people to the practice of the law. And so that's what we have here in the book of Ezra, the story of these two returns. Just kind of keep that straight. When they did return, they primarily just re-inhabited Jerusalem and the surrounding villages and towns. They weren't anywhere near as big as they had been when they were conquered by the Babylonians and taken to captivity. And so they were just a small province in the Persian Empire. They didn't have independence. They weren't an independent kingdom. They did not have a king who was their own king. They were just subjects to the king of Persia. And so everything they did was under his control. And that comes out in the book of Ezra as well. Eight of the writing of the book of Ezra, somewhere around 450 to 400 B.C., the last books of the Bible were all written during this time period. I'm talking about the Old Testament. Haggai and Zechariah, they were part of the first returnees. But the books, and Esther, some happens between the first and second return. But the books of Ezra and Nehemiah and Malachi, they're really chronologically the last books of the Old Testament. And so that's the period in which Ezra was written. The title in Hebrew is Ezra or Ezra Nehemiah. Why Ezra Nehemiah? Because originally in the Hebrew Bible, the books of Ezra and Nehemiah were one book. And they were that way for a very long time. In fact, in the Hebrew Bible, they weren't separated until like the 15th century A.D. And in the original Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, it was one book, Ezra and Nehemiah. Why was it one book? Well, they were contemporaries, and they did work together. And the story of Ezra dovetails into Nehemiah, and so, you know, it kind of makes sense that it would be one book. Why were they ever separated? Well, out of convenience, because, you know, they're two separate men. But that's just the history of how that goes. The Greeks referred to him as Esdras, and that creates a little bit of confusion because there are some apocryphal books called Esdras, and people get confused about that. But here's a chart that kind of shows, again, these three groups of returnees. Zerubbabel and the governor and Joshua the high priest, they led the first return. They came back in 536 B.C. And over the period of 20 years, they finally finished the temple in 516 B.C. And this was the largest group that returned. They came back with something around 50,000 people. Ezra, again, you know, going from 516 to 458, 58 years, Ezra returns smaller group of returnees, about 2,000 people. And then about 15 years later, Nehemiah comes back, and not very many people with him, but he brings a lot of money and resources, and he rebuilds the wall around Jerusalem. Nehemiah does that. Nehemiah was about. This chart kind of helps to keep all of that straight. Again, Ezra 1 through 6 is about the first return, 536 to 516. They rebuild the temple. It was during this time that the prophets of Haggai and Zechariah worked, and their prophecies are an encouragement to the Israelites to rebuild the temple. That's what Haggai and Zechariah are about. And again, about 50,000 people came back with this group. 58 years later, after the finishing of the temple, Ezra comes back. And that's what Ezra 7 through 10 is about. So Ezra has two parts, the first return, the second return. It was during this 58-year gap between the first and second return that Esther lived. Esther was the queen of the king of Persia. So she was among the Jews who had stayed in captivity, or stayed in the Persian Empire. And so that explains where Esther falls in. And then after Ezra's work of reform, 13 years later, Nehemiah comes back, and he rebuilds the wall around Jerusalem. And it was during this period of time that the last prophet of the Old Testament wrote his book, the book of Malachi. Any question about any of that? It's all straight in your head? Well, it's hard to say because it doesn't tell us when he died or how old he was. But you have to imagine that he lived a pretty good long time, because he must have been a fairly mature individual at the point that he led the second return. And he was there when Nehemiah came and was continuing to be active. He was a supporter and contemporary of Nehemiah. Some 13 years later. And so, who knows how old he lived to be. But lived a pretty good long life. So here's another chart that kind of helped fall straight. Again, these three stories, the story of the first return under Joshua and Zerubbabel, and the fact that they met with resistance by the Samaritans, and that's what the first six chapters of Ezra are about. They're trying to rebuild the temple, but these foreigners who have moved into the land during the period of the captivity, they don't like the fact that these Jews have come back, and they don't like the fact that the Jews are rebuilding the temple, and so they make trouble for them, and it slows down and hinders the rebuilding of the temple. In fact, it's delayed for some 20 years before it's finally finished. And so those are the enemies during that period of time. And then what we'll see, of course, if we get to the book of Esther, is that there's another conflict. And in this conflict, there's Haman, who's trying to destroy the Jews back over there in Persia. And Esther, of course, that story saves her people by going to the king and making an appeal to him. And so that's what the book of Esther is about. But in the story of Ezra and Nehemiah, which happens later, there's still these foreigners that are living about, and they don't like the fact that Nehemiah rebuilds the wall. And so they try to stop that. And Nehemiah is successful in overcoming their opposition. And so all three of these stories have a similar theme. And the theme is God's people trying to rebuild, trying to restore, being met with opposition, but by the help, with the help of God and by their determination to be faithful to God, they are able to complete their mission. Whether it's Zerubbabel and Joshua, or Ezra, or Nehemiah, or Esther, they all, through their devotion and faithfulness, are able to overcome this opposition, and with God's help, to prevail. And so that's what all these stories are about. So they're very good stories in terms of teaching us about how we need to be in our generation that we too will meet with opposition, that there will be enemies of the Lord, enemies of the Lord's cause. They won't like what we're saying. They won't like what we're doing. They won't like what we're trying to build. And they will oppose it. But we need to be faithful and have trust that God will work with us and give us success. So it's great in that regard. There are also stories about redemption, about something that was lost can be restored, something that seemingly is gone forever can come back, which is really the theme of the whole Bible when you think about it. Paradise lost can become paradise restored. A relationship with God that has been broken can be mended. A promised land that has been forfeited can be reclaimed. It's almost like life from death, resurrection, return, like Ezekiel's valley of the dry bones. Can these bones live again? Yes, they can. You know, God can bring the bones back together and reattach them and add the flesh and add the skin, and these men who are supposedly dead and gone can come back to life. And so really, all of these themes that are touched on in the Bible and what the Bible is eventually all about is restoration. Restoration of fellowship, or restoration of paradise, heaven, of being with God. And so, in spite of the opposition, in spite of the devil and the devil's servants who always oppose, we can still prevail. In terms of the nature of the book of Ezra, it's a historical narrative. It just tells the story as history. And it actually uses a lot of historical records, official documents. Ezra was a keeper. He was a recorder, a scribe. And that comes across very strongly in the book of Ezra. That the lists and the numbers and the genealogies and the official decrees and documents. Ezra's all about the paperwork, you know. But the paperwork's important because it establishes legitimacy and validity. That this is real. This has actually happened. The king of Persia actually did issue this decree. And these people actually did come back. And here are the records that prove it. And so it's impressive in that regard. Some parts of the book of Ezra are recorded in Aramaic. And most of it's in Hebrew. It's in Aramaic. Well, what is that about? Aramaic and Hebrew are related languages. They're very closely related, but they're not exactly the same. I was trying to think of something that you could compare it to. It's not a really good comparison, but it's like the difference between Spanish and Italian. Very closely related languages, obviously Romance languages. I've been told by Italians that they can kind of understand Spanish. I don't have any personal experience with that. But Hebrew and Aramaic are close enough so that you can kind of understand each other, but they're different. So why are some parts of Ezra in Aramaic? Because the Persian Empire, they spoke Aramaic. That was the official language of their empire. Why would they have a language so closely related to Hebrew? Because all of these Mesopotamian peoples spoke similar languages. They lived in the same part of the world, and all of the languages were descended from an original language that connected all of them together. And so there are parts of Daniel and there are parts of Ezra that are in Aramaic, and especially these official decrees, the decrees that come from the king of Persia, they're written in Aramaic because that's how they were written, as a decree from the king of Persia. They were written in Aramaic. Any question about any of that? Okay, Ezra, interestingly, was a priest. In fact, he was from a very important priestly family at one time. His ancestor was the high priest Zadok. He's also, on top of being a priest, a scribe. And he's dated to during the reign of Artaxerxes the First, and that's how we know basically about the time of his return, because it says that it was in the seventh year of Artaxerxes. Well, Artaxerxes began reigning in 465. The seventh year would be somewhere around 452. And Nehemiah, he was also a servant, an attendant to the same king, Artaxerxes, and he led his return in the 12th year of Artaxerxes, and so that's the way that worked. And so we can date when these events happened accordingly. As I already mentioned, the books of Ezra and Nehemiah originally were just one book, and that's the way they are in the Septuagint. It was one book. They both contain the same genealogy. Both of them thought it was important to list the genealogy of the returnees. We'll talk about why we're so concerned about that in a moment. As I mentioned, Ezra doesn't begin the I section until chapter 7 because the first six chapters, he wasn't there. It was something that happened decades earlier. But starting in chapter 7, he was there, and so he starts using the first person singular. And as I say, Ezra and Nehemiah were possibly combined because they worked together. They were contemporaries. Anything, any questions? Conversations? Okay. So the basic outline of Ezra is fairly simple. The first six chapters are about the first group of returnees rebuilding the temple in the face of opposition. The second section, starting in chapter 7, is the return of Ezra with the second group of people. And it's mostly a story of restoration, of rededication, recommitment to the law and to the worship of God. Because now that it's some 58 years after the building of the temple, doesn't necessarily mean everything is all well and good. Because just as Israel has always had the problem of lapsing and becoming less diligent and devoted, failing to keep the law, there needs to be reform, there needs to be restoration, revival, rededication. That's what Ezra is all about. So it continues that constant pattern we see in the Old Testament of God's people becoming lax and unfaithful and the need to restore to faithful observance of God's covenant. So that's the two sections of the book of Ezra. So what is the purpose of Ezra? Records the return from captivity, shows that God's hand was involved in that. It legitimizes the reestablishment. It shows that it was done properly and correctly with the right documents, not only from a legal standpoint within the Persian Empire, but also from a religious standpoint by the law of God and with logical records to show that the men who came and restored the priestly service in the temple were qualified, they were legitimate, they had the credentials to show it. And so it is a tie. It's a tie between the past and the present and the future, showing that nothing was lost, that true restoration took place. And of course, it encourages loyalty to the law. And that's a great point to draw from any book of the Bible, but that's certainly what Ezra is about. And so it emphasizes the priesthood and the Levites. It emphasizes the law. It emphasizes the temple. It emphasizes the commandments, because these are all the things that Ezra was all about. Any thoughts? All right. So, who are the main characters? Joshua the high priest. He returned with Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel is this guy, but we'll talk about Joshua first. Joshua was high priest. He worked with Zerubbabel. He led the people to Jerusalem. Together with Zerubbabel, they rebuilt the altar, they reinstituted the worship of God, and they started the process of rebuilding the temple, but it took 20 years until they finally got it right. Joshua figures prominently in the book of Zechariah. Remember, the two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, were the ones who came and encouraged the people to finish rebuilding the temple. After they started rebuilding it, they stopped rebuilding it. And the foundation lay bare for many years until Haggai and Zechariah come along. And one of the things that Zechariah does is he gets Zerubbabel and he gets Joshua and he brings them together and he says, these are the guys and they're going to rebuild this temple. And then he does something kind of interesting. He takes two crowns. I think one's gold, one silver, and he weaves them together into one crown. And he places this united crown on Joshua, the high priest. And he says, this guy's the branch. This guy is the branch. And the two offices have become one in the branch. That's very significant because when you tie in Psalm 110, the idea of uniting the royal line with the priesthood into one office and anointing and making one guy a king priest, and this guy's called the branch, and the figure of the branch is messianic, of course, over and over again in the prophets. The idea is that just as the dynasty of David seems to be cut off and gone, there's still a root, there's still a stump. And from that root or stump, there will spring forth a sprig, a branch, a little twig will come. And that branch is the Messiah. And he will be crowned. And he will reunite the king and priest. And of course, in this case, the guy who's selected to represent branch, present the Messiah, is a guy named Joshua. And of course, the significance of that is that Joshua is the Hebrew form of the name Jesus, Yeshua. So, very significant character in the story of God's plan of redemption. Rebuilding the temple. You see that? Tear down this temple, and in 3 days I'll build it back up again. That's our Joshua, rebuilding the temple of God. So it's very significant in terms of the foreshadowing of what Jesus would accomplish. Zerubbabel was the grandson of Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim was really the last legitimate king of Judah. I think it was his uncle Zedekiah was put in his place when Jehoiakim was taken away in captivity. But Jehoiakim was always seen to be the legitimate king. And it was his grandson Zerubbabel who comes back to Judah. He cannot be king because the king of Persia is king. You can only be a governor under the king of Persia at this time. And although Zerubbabel is not called governor in the book of Ezra, he is called governor of Judah in the prophet Haggai. Haggai 1:1 says that Zerubbabel was the governor of Judah. But he's the grandson of the Davidic dynasty, and so he's the rightful heir. He just can't be king yet. But because when the rightful heir, who is the descendant of David, eventually is crowned king, that is the Messiah. That is the one who is the branch. And Zerubbabel is not him, but he's the one from whom Jesus is descended. And Jesus is descended from Zerubbabel because he is in that rightful David. Zerubbabel was the 18th great-grandfather of Jesus. And you don't think that these genealogies are significant or important? They absolutely are important because that's the claim to the throne, that you are a descendant of this man. Yes, that's right. And it was men like Ezra. You read the book of Ezra and it may seem a little tedious that these records are, you read through these genealogy lists, but that's exactly what they were about. They were about establishing the legitimacy of the priests and the king. Okay, so they led the first group, Zerubbabel with Joshua together, led the first group of Jews, about 50,000 back, this is about like a 900-mile journey to Jerusalem and rebuilt Jerusalem. And Joshua and Zerubbabel together, they rebuilt the altar and eventually the second temple. But it took them 20 years to get that. And then that leaves us with Ezra. His name, maybe it means Jehovah helps, so it's not quite so obvious. And he, as I said, he was a descendant of Zadok, who was high priest at one time. And he was also a scribe. And he led a smaller group of returnees back to Jerusalem in 456, 457, 458 B.C. Okay, that's my introduction to the book of Ezra. Yes. That's before the captivity. Remnant is the right word. A remnant return, which is exactly what Jeremiah had prophesied. He said only a remnant will return, and that's exactly what happened, only a remnant. Now, eventually, from that 50,000 and a few other smaller groups, one led by Ezra, the population increased and increased more until, who knows, at some point they may have gotten back to that 2 or 3 million. But at this point, you can see how small they were, how they were just within a hair's breadth of just being wiped out. And things like rebuilding the temple and rebuilding the wall, these are significant things. You know, We think in terms of, what difference does it make whether they have a wall around their city or not? It makes a huge difference. When you're surrounded by enemies and your little community of Israelites is under threat all the time, that wall is very important. Psychologically, yes, but for actual security, you better believe it. And so men like Ezra and Nehemiah, they held this community together and kept it from disappearing. And so that's the significance of that. You make an excellent point that there was actually a purpose or usefulness in what became what is referred to as the diaspora, the dispersion of the Jews throughout the Roman Empire, and even beyond the Roman Empire, that wherever these Jews settled, they too maintained their integrity and built synagogues and studied the law, and to the degree that they could, observe the law. They couldn't observe it completely because to do it, correctly, you'd have to go to the temple in Jerusalem and offer sacrifices. But living dispersed across the known world, they did what they could to maintain their community as Israelites. But what that did was it sowed seeds, pockets of people throughout the world who had the hope of the Messiah and his return in their heart. And so the apostles could come to these communities and go to these synagogues and say the Messiah has come and his name is Yeshua and he has fulfilled the prophecies and he is our king and he is reigning. And it allowed for there to be a starting point in all of these communities for churches to be started. And so the captivity, as you say, even though they didn't all return to Jerusalem, it still made it possible for the return of the Messiah to accomplish his worldwide mission, not just to return to Judah and Jerusalem, but to bring the message of the Messiah to the whole world. So that was a significant development. Okay, we're almost out of time. If you look in, like I said, when we ended our study of Second Chronicles, if you look at the very end of Second Chronicles, it ends with the same thing that Ezra begins with. And that's this decree from Cyrus, the king of Persia, that says, you guys can go home now. And remember what What created that situation was the overthrowing of the Babylonian Empire. The Babylonians were the ones who conquered Judah and carried them away into captivity. When the Babylonians were overthrown by the Persians, the first king of the Persian Empire, Cyrus, he changed the policy. His policy was, everybody can go home. If you were brought here from some foreign country, you can go back to your foreign country. And it was, you know, according to Ezra, it was from the hand of God. It was God's will that this happened. And so God raises up Cyrus and puts this in Cyrus's mind. And it's God, really, who is the one who issues the decree. Cyrus is just God's puppet, God's instrument getting this done. So Cyrus issues this decree, and he says, everybody can go home. And in Ezra, in 2 Chronicles and Ezra, it's very specific to the Jews. He issues a decree to the Jews. Well, it was a general policy. And we know it was a general policy because of this thing right here. This is called the Cyrus Cylinder. It was dug up in the remains, the archaeological ruins of Babylon. And actually, they've found two copies of this through the years. And basically, what this is it's propaganda. It's Cyrus becoming king, and it gives his genealogy, it gives his credentials, it says how much better he is than the last king of Babylon, Nabonidus, and how lousy that guy was, and how much better Cyrus is. And it talks about his magnanimity, his generosity, his goodness. And one of the things it says is that he says, you people can go home. You can go back and restore your temples and reestablish your cult centers and worship your gods as you see fit. And so that's part of kind of the propaganda, the way of establishing the goodwill over his empire, saying, look, I am generous. I am the great shepherd. I can help you. And you go home, worship your gods as you have done in the past. And so even though it doesn't specifically mention the Jews, it doesn't really specifically mention much of anybody, just kind of as a generic statement about restoring the cult centers and the worship of these various gods. But this is the exact language that's most pertinent to our subject. It talks about the sacred centers on the other side of the Tigris, which is over in the area that Judah would have been, whose sanctuaries had been abandoned for a long time. I returned the images of the gods who had resided there to their places, and I let them dwell in eternal abodes. I gathered all the inhabitants, returned to them their dwellings. And so this is a generic policy of Cyrus to let people go home, rebuild temples and so forth. And that's what prompted the return that we read about here in Ezra chapter 1. Yes, that's exactly right. He is prophesied and predicted by, I think it's Isaiah, and that would have been about 170 years before Cyrus ever came on the scene. He says, this is my man. He's going to do it. I call him to do it. So it's one of those examples of fulfilled prophecy. You're absolutely right. That's right. Now, you remember, Daniel was a servant in the Babylonian Empire, and when the Persians took over, he became a key figure in the Persian Empire as well. He would have been pretty old at that point, but he was still a servant of the Persian Empire. And so there was some connections there that are very important. Well, that tie into the book of Daniel. Well, we're out of time here. So please do read the book of Ezra. I'm not sure, you know, some of this we can get through fairly quickly, but certainly just read the first six chapters of the book of Ezra. and be prepared to talk about those next Wednesday.
Good to have everyone at our service this evening. Just a few announcements before we...